Try to draw a square circle. You can't, because the problem itself is meaningless. Try to arrange the things in this room so that they're all up and none of them down. It is meaningless. Such a problem cannot ever be solved. So try to have light without dark, or dark without light. It can never be solved. So the attempt to solve problems that are basically insoluble and to work at it through your whole life, that is dukkha. Now, he went on to analyze this, that there are what he called three signs of being. The first is dukkha itself, frustration. The second is anitya. And this means the letter A in Sanskrit at the beginning of a word is often the equivalent of our non. So nitya means permanent. Anitya means impermanent. That every manifestation of life is impermanent. And therefore, our quest to make things permanent, to straighten everything out, to get it fixed, is an impossible and insoluble problem. And therefore, we experience dukkha, or this sense of fundamental pain and frustration, as a result of trying to make things permanent. And the third sign of being is called anatman. Now, you know from my talk on Hinduism that the word atman means self. Anatman means, therefore, non-self. That there is in you no real ego. Now, I've explained that already. I've explained, in talking about Hinduism, that the idea of the ego is a social institution. It has no physical reality. It is simply, the ego is your symbol of yourself. Just as the word water is a noise, which symbolizes a certain liquid reality, so the idea of the ego, the role you play, who you are, is not the same as your living organism. Your ego has absolutely nothing to do with the way you color your eyes, shape your body, circulate your blood. That's the real you, but it's certainly not your ego. Because you don't even know how it's done from the standpoint of your conscious attention. So the idea of anatman is firstly that the ego is unreal. There isn't one. Now then, this then is the first truth. There is this situation that we have dukkha or frustration because we are fighting the changingness of things. And because we don't realize that the ego, the I, is unreal. The second of the Four Noble Truths is then called Trishna. Trishna is a Sanskrit word again and is the root of our word thirst. And it's usually translated desire. But it is better translated clinging, grabbing, or there's an excellent modern American slangy word, hang-up. That is exactly what Trishna is, a hang-up. Trishna is clutching. As, for example, what we call smother love. When a mother is so afraid that her children may get into trouble, that she protects them excessively, and as a result of this, prevents them from growing. Or when lovers cling to each other excessively and have to sign documents that they will curse and swear to love each other always. They are in a state of Trishna. And this is the same thing as holding on to yourself so tightly that you strangle yourself. Now, so the second truth then about Trishna is that the cause of dukkha is Trishna. Clinging is what makes suffering. If you don't recognize that this whole world is a phantasmagoria, an amazing illusion, a weaving of smoke, and you try to hold on to it, you see, then you start suffering. Seriously suffering. Trishna is in turn based upon avidya. The same negative, vidya, from the root vid, means knowledge, as in the Latin video and the English vision. Avidya, therefore, is ignorance. Gnosis, gna, means, of course, to know. Knowledge is the same thing as gnosis in Greek. To know. So this is not to know. To ignore. To overlook. We ignore all kinds of things because we notice only what we think noteworthy. And therefore, our vision of everything is highly selective. We pick out certain things and say, that's what's there, just as we select and notice the figure rather than the background. Sometimes I draw this on the blackboard and ask the question, what have I drawn? What would you say? What have I drawn? A circle. Any other suggestions?
A hole in black.
Yeah, you're getting the point. I've drawn a wall with a hole in it, you see. But ordinarily, you've been reading my books. But ordinarily people see the ball, the circle, the ring or whatever, and never think of the background. Because they ignore the background. Just as one thinks that you can have pleasure without pain. You want pleasure, the figure. And don't realize that pain is the background. So avidya is this state of restricted consciousness, restricted attention, that moves through life unaware of the fact that to be implies not to be, and vice versa. So now the third noble truth is called nirvana. This word means blow out. Nira is a negative word, again, like a. Vana is blowing. So it's a kind of outblowing. Now, in breathing, you know that breath is life. The Greek word, you may pronounce it pneuma or pnefma, is the same as spirit. And spirit means breath. In the book of Genesis, when God had made the clay figurine that was later to be Adam, he breathed the breath of life into its nostrils. And it became alive, because life is breath. But now, if you hold your breath, you lose it. He that would save his life will lose it. So breathe in, breathe in, breathe in, get as much air as you can, and Trishna, cling, and you lose it. So nirvana means breathe out. What a relief that was. The sigh of relief. Let it go. Because it'll come back to you if you let it go. But if you don't let it go, you'll just suffocate. So a person in the state of nirvana is what we might call a blown out person, like blow your mind. Let go. Don't cling. And then you're in the state of nirvana. And I re-emphasize the point. This is not, I'm not preaching, see? I'm not saying this is what you ought to do. I'm simply pointing out a state of affairs that is so. There's no moralism in this whatsoever. It's simply pointing out, like, if you put your hand into the fire, you'll get burned. You can get burned if you want to. That's okay. But if it so happens that you don't want to get burned, then you don't put your hand in the fire. So in the same way, if you don't want to be in a state of anxiety all the time, and again I emphasize, if you like to be anxious, it's perfectly all right. See, Buddhism never hurries anyone on. They say, you've got all eternity through which to live in various forms. And therefore, you don't have just one life in which you've got to avoid eternal damnation. You can go running around the wheel and the rat race and play that game just as long as you want to, so long as you think it's fun. But if there comes a time when you don't think it's fun, you don't have to do it. So I wouldn't say to anyone who disagrees with me and who says, well, I think we ought to engage the forces of evil in battle and put this world to right, and so on and so forth, and arrange everything in this world so that it's all up. Try it, please. It's perfectly okay. Go on doing that. But if you see that it's futile, then you can let go. Don't try to cling. Relax. And if you do that, you're in the state of nirvana. And you become a Buddha. And of course it means that you become a rather astonishing person. You may, of course, be subtle about it and make like you're a very ordinary person so that you don't get people mixed up. Because if you are a very astonishing person, everybody wants to be like you. And they use you as an object of trishna, of clinging. They rely on you. You get a transference on you. Everybody comes running around and says, please help me. I'd like to be like you are. And then you have to get rid of them. See, that's the difference between a doctor and a clergyman. I shouldn't say things like this, but doctors try to get rid of their patients. Clergymen try to get them hooked on the medicine so that they will become addicts to the church. And that's too bad, because there is a saying in ancient Christianity, crux medicina mundi, which means the cross, the medicine of the world. But you don't make medicine a diet. And so in Buddhism, the Buddha explained that his doctrine, his method, was a raft. It's sometimes called a yana. The word Y-A-N-A, yana, means a vehicle, a conveyance. And when you cross a river on a raft, and you get to the other shore, you don't pick up the raft and carry it on your back. You leave it behind. But people who are what I would call hooked on religion are always on the raft. They're going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth on the raft. So the clergyman tends to turn into a ferryman who's always on the raft and never gets over to the other shore himself. Now, something to be said for that, because how are we going to get the raft back to the first shore to bring over the other people? See? Somebody has to volunteer to take the back journey. But he must be awfully careful to realize that the real objective is to get the people across and set them free. If you dedicate yourself to ferrying people across, don't ask them to come back on the raft with you, because you'll get overcrowded and people will think that the raft is the goal rather than the other shore. So when I find this in actual practice, that when clergymen do not ever ask for money, and it's all right, you know, like a doctor who simply charges a fee, says, you come to me, you pay me so much. But the clergyman says, he doesn't say pay me so much, he says, we would like your pledge, your voluntary contribution. See, and then nobody knows what to give. And but he has to go calling around all sorts of places. He becomes a fundraiser for this big project, the church. And it's a bad scene. Because if any church were really successful in liberating people, there would be no problems of economics at all. Because people would keep coming. As soon as you got rid of people, like a doctor who gets rid of people becomes famous. Because they're cured. And so if in a certain church scene, people are cured and they all therefore leave the church, more come in. There's a perpetual tide of more people. So you get a huge turnover. And that's the way to work it. That's the idea of the raft. Now then, the fourth noble truth is called marga. This word means path. And the way of Buddhism is often called the Noble Eightfold Path, because there are eight phases. I won't say steps, because they're not sequential. They're all simultaneous. Once upon a time, there's a very, very great Japanese scholar, D.T. Suzuki, who was giving a lecture at the University of Hawaii on Buddhism, and was explaining he come to the Fourth Noble Truth. And he said, today we come to Fourth Noble Truth, called a Noble Eightfold Path. First step of Noble Eightfold Path, called Shoken. He was using Japanese name. Shoken mean right view. Aura Buddhism is right view. Right view mean no particular view, no fixed view. Or Buddhism, Shoken, right view. Second step of Noble Eightfold Path. Oh, I forget second step. You look it up in the book. This man was one of the most terrific scholars in Chinese, Sanskrit, Tibetan, Japanese, and so on. So I'm not going to bother you with all the individual steps of the Eightfold Path. It really... all of them are subsumed under three headings, of which you can say that right view, which in Sanskrit is samyag, samyak is a very curious phrase. It doesn't mean right in our sense of correct. Sam is the same really as our word sum, total, complete, all-inclusive. We might use the word integrated, as when we say a person has integrity. That a person who has integrity, we mean he's all of a piece. He's not divided against himself. So in this sense of samyak, drishti, this is related to the word darshan, which means a point of view or viewing. When you go to visit a great guru or teacher, you have darshan, you look at him, and you offer your reverence to him. This is darshan. Many senses of it, but it means simply to view. Look at the view. So the Samyak Darshan is the complete view. For example, let's take the constellation called the Big Dipper.